Behind the Bite podcast is part of a network of podcasts that are good for the world. Check out podcasts like the Full of Shit podcast, After the First Marriage podcast, and Eating Recovery Academy over at practiceofthepractice.com/network. Welcome to Behind the Bite podcast. This podcast is about the real life struggles women face with food, body image, and weight. We're here to help heal, inspire, and create better, healthier lives. Welcome. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. So if anyone out there listening is confused about diets, weight, health, and really what you need to do to eat, and if you still think about food in terms of healthy food, unhealthy food, bad food, good food, and you still find yourself reading things on social media and kind of trying to figure out, well, wait a minute, I'm hearing all these contradictory things and my doctor's saying one thing and telling me I need to exercise more and eat less. And, you know, I've said a lot of these things on my podcast before and had guests on here and we've kind of hashed these things out. But it's amazing to me that these things are still confusing and that there's still so much contradictory information and people are still really searching for like this holy grail of what it means to be at the optimal weight or optimal health. And I hear things that people say and it kind of baffles my mind still. And I just don't know what needs to be done for people to not equate weight with health or to really look at the BMI and things like that as BS, really. That being said, I have a wonderful guest on here today. She is amazing. She's an expert in the field. I followed her work for years. I'm really excited to have her on. She's just written a workbook with other experts in the field. And she's really just going to get into all of this and hopefully help clarify a lot of this for all of you that are listening. I don't think any of this can be said enough. So, you know, if you've heard some of this stuff on my podcast before, I think, like I said, it cannot be said enough. We can't have enough discussions about this. Toxic diet culture messaging is so loud and prevalent out there. And so, like I said, we just need to keep the discussion going. And if any of you continue to have questions about any of this, DM me, keep the questions coming. The reason I continue to have these shows and talk about these things is because I get the questions from all of you and I do see the confusion and I do see the frustration from everybody, whether it's on social media or from the people I'm working with in my private practice. So that being said, I really want to introduce our guest. You may actually know her because she's written some books. She's had a podcast that's had a great following. She's somebody that, like I said, I've been following for years. And so I'm really excited to have her on. Christy Harrison is a journalist, registered dietitian, and certified intuitive eating counselor. And she's the author of The Wellness Trap, Break Free from Diet Culture, Disinformation, and Dubious Diagnoses, and Find Your True Well-Being. And The Anti-Diet, Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-Being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating. And the co-author of The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, and the Making Peace with Food card deck. She produces and hosts two podcasts, Rethinking Wellness and Food Psych, which have helped tens of thousands of listeners around the world think critically about diet and wellness culture and develop more peaceful relationships with food. And in addition to her media work, Christy often offers online courses and private intuitive eating coaching to help people all over the world make peace with food and their bodies. All right. Well, Christy, welcome to the show. I'm really, really excited to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
So, you know, for people who don't know who you are, would you mind sharing a little bit about your background and how you got to this place in your career that you're at?
Sure. Yeah. My background is sort of a winding one or multi-hyphenate one, I suppose. I am a journalist and a registered dietitian and a certified intuitive eating counselor. I came to this work through my work in journalism. I started out when I was in my early 20s, went right into journalism out of school. Actually, my first journalism job was while I was in school, in college, working at an environmental magazine as an editorial assistant. And from there, I kept sort of pursuing this like environmental, health, nutrition kind of beat. And, you know, that was really what my focus was. And food as well. Food and farming was really interesting to me. And all of that stuff was super interesting to me because I was struggling with an eating disorder at the time that was undiagnosed and untreated. And, you know, I was kind of sublimating in some ways my obsession with food, I guess, and just the fact that, you know, I wasn't eating enough made me so obsessed with food that I wanted to like learn all about it and research it and spend my entire days reporting stories about food. And so pretty quickly fell into those beats. And it was through that process of like reporting and writing on food and, you know, having a disordered eating and eating disorder flying under the radar and be sort of praised in some ways, you know, like I was praised for being the quote unquote healthy one and for seeming to have it all together with food. But I would secretly be binging on all the foods I wasn't allowing myself and then over-exercising to compensate. And then the cycle would repeat. And I was trying to be very like whole food, plant-based, minimally processed, blah, blah, blah. You know, it was very, this was like the early 2000s. So it was kind of the early days of Michael Pollan and the like farm to table movement and all that. So I was really on that train. I should back up a little bit and say I grew up with a really good relationship with food. I was an intuitive eater. I didn't have anybody interfering in my relationship with food. I was privileged to be, you know, to grow up in a house with economic stability and access to food. So we never had to worry about where food was coming from. And then I also had thin privilege, which is like just the unearned advantages coming with being in a smaller body in this society. So nobody told me I had to lose weight. Nobody, you know, made a thing of my size. I certainly had some body image issues as I went through puberty, but they were pretty, you know, normative as things go. It wasn't anything that triggered disordered eating or an eating disorder at that time. So I kind of sailed through childhood and adolescence with, you know, unscathed relationship with food. But then when I got to college and actually when I studied abroad in Paris for my junior year, that's when I gained a little bit of weight. And then suddenly, like, all of the societal messaging and conditioning I had picked up all my life about food and body stuff came sort of rushing to the fore, and I decided I had to lose weight and then really spiraled into disordered eating. So that's like where I was when I graduated and started my journalism career. And through that process of writing and reporting about food, nutrition, and health, I had different jobs at different publications and also was freelance. And so kind of like sometimes I'd be focusing more on the nutrition side. Sometimes I'd be focusing more on just the straight up food side. And I did get a job at a straight up food magazine, Gourmet, that was my last full-time job as a magazine editor in 2007. And that was, you know, a really helpful immersion, I think, in pleasurable relationship with food and seeing how people related to food in a way that wasn't disordered. I subsequently learned a few of my coworkers actually did struggle with disordered eating and were sort of attracted to it for the same reason that I was. But on the whole, I think a lot of people had good relationships with food and modeled that there. And so that was a helpful piece of my recovery. I was also in therapy for anxiety and, you know, other issues. And I didn't really specifically bring my food issues to therapy, but they found their way in, of course. And even though my therapist at the time didn't specialize in it, she was really helpful just addressing some of the underlying issues that were related to my disordered eating and, you know, my lack of self-compassion, my just being so hard on myself and so driven and controlled. She kind of helped me loosen all that up. And I think that plus the research that I was doing and the self-help that I was reading related to intuitive eating and healing our relationships with food really helped me to recover. And so I did end up getting into really solid recovery from disordered eating. And I had decided to go back to school when Gourmet, the magazine I was working at, closed in 2009. I actually heard the rumblings that that was coming and applied and got into school and was already in my program when it happened. So I was lucky. But so I decided to, you know, become a registered dietitian, get my master's in public health and nutrition. And this whole idea of like this career shift was, A, I'm going to be like, you know, Michael Pollan or Marion Nestle. Like, I'm going to have these credentials to help me write about food and nutrition from an expert perspective. And I'm, you know, B, I'm going to help, quote unquote, solve the obesity epidemic, because that was my lens at the time. I really bought into that idea and wanted to help shrink people's bodies and thought I knew how to do it through like food systems approaches and farm to table and, you know, helping people stop eating processed food and all that stuff. So as you can probably tell by the way I'm talking about it now, that I don't believe that anymore. And I subsequently sort of learned a lot that helped me move away from that way of thinking. But I was very bought into it at the time when I went back to school. And throughout the process of my training, I ended up specializing in eating disorders. And that's when I really got exposed to intuitive eating and weight inclusive, weight neutral approaches, and really started to question the beliefs that I had about body size and weight and realize how harmful they were. And so that's when I ultimately pivoted my career in this more anti-diet direction that I've taken. And I never stopped doing journalism. I always did, you know, some sort of freelancing along the way. And I decided to start a podcast in 2013 about disordered eating and sort of what I was learning. And that grew into my podcast, Food Psych. And now I have a second podcast as well, where I talk about wellness culture and misinformation and sort of these larger issues that are tangled up in people's relationship with food and their bodies.
That's fantastic. And as you know, so many things in such a long trajectory. And, you know, obviously I've known about you for a long time and was very happy to have you on and, you know, lots of questions because, as you said, you were of the mindset that I think a lot of people right now are in and do believe in all the things that, you know, you said you transitioned out of during your program. So I'm actually curious, how did you shift your mindset from thinking there was this obesity crisis and that, you know, there was not a need to make people smaller and that health and weight weren't related and to be anti-diet? Like, how did you shift? Because I know a lot of people still believe that health and weight are correlated and there is this horrible obesity epidemic and the only way to obtain physical health and well-being is to diet, and there's good foods, bad foods, healthy, unhealthy. There's like all of this, especially right now with, you know, you and I were talking a bit before about the Ozempic, you know, I call it the crisis right now. But how did you make that flip? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think it was a slow process and it involved getting exposed to different ways of thinking and then getting into the science. I think for me, like I've always been pretty science minded. I'm a journalist, so I have this sort of lens of like, we need to look at evidence and do some solid reporting. And then especially with my education and training in public health and dietetics, I had to take like research methods classes and, you know, learn how to critically assess studies. And I think that sort of matched up well with my like critical thinking side of my brain anyway. And I did a lot of like literature reviews and some of my early jobs in nutrition and dietetics. And so I was like spending a lot of time deep in the science. And I think that was really helpful because, you know, when I started to learn to critically think about research, I started applying that critical lens to the research we had on weight and health and was thinking, oh, wait, okay, these are just associations. Like correlation is not causation. And yes, there is a link, an association between higher weight and certain poor health outcomes. There's also like a reverse association, it seems to be, or an association in the other direction where higher weight is associated with better health outcomes on certain measures, like if people already have cardiovascular disease or diabetes or, you know, certain other conditions, or just for mortality in general, there seems to be like kind of a different shaped curve than you would imagine. You know, I forget if it's a J-shaped curve or a U-shaped curve, but it's like, you know, the lowest risks are actually for people at sort of mid to higher weights in terms of mortality. And so it just was like, it really made me think critically about this evidence that we had. And then I was exposed to, through a journalist friend who was a scientific skeptic, you know, was involved in like the skeptical community and critical thinking about science and, you know, looking at science-based medicine as opposed to just, you know, what's called sometimes called evidence-based medicine, which can sometimes pull in like just sort of clinical, you know, doctors being like, well, this is what worked for my patient, so I'm going to do this, rather than like actually looking at the science and sort of getting grounded in what the science actually says. You know, this friend was like really interested in science-based medicine and sort of critical thinking about healthcare in general. And so kind of introduced me, and he was very interested in critical thinking about weight science specifically, and got interested in weight inclusive approaches and the health at every size field, and introduced me to those ideas. And I was still very bought into, you know, kind of the dominant paradigm, my way of thinking about it at the time, which was like obesity is bad and, you know, weight loss is good and we have to make people smaller to make them healthier. And I did some reporting projects with him. You know, he was writing for me while I was guest editing a package for his magazine. And he wrote some pieces that were like, got me really thinking, you know, and we debated back and forth. And I just started being exposed to this other way of looking at things. I didn't actually do anything with that for a number of years after that, because I think I was just still really bought in. And I was also still in my recovery, like early in my recovery, I still was struggling actually at the time with my own disordered eating. And so I had a lot of my own deeply held beliefs about food and weight that were like fueling that disordered eating and being perpetuated by it too, that prevented me, I think, from really looking at things differently. But once I started shifting and moving into the eating disorder field, I started going to conferences and trainings and stuff where that information that my friend had put on my radar was being presented as like, hey, you know, this is best practices for preventing eating disorders and perhaps also treating, and, you know, that a weight inclusive approach was really an important approach to be aware of, at least as an eating disorder specialist. But, you know, as I got further into the literature, I was like, oh, wow, this is really important. And I think this is really what we need to, you know, the way that we need to approach weight and health in general is in this weight inclusive way. And weight inclusive means, you know, not looking at weight loss or not looking at weight itself as a determinant of health, but looking at other health promoting approaches that people can do that are independent of weight. So not prescribing weight loss for health reasons, but actually prescribing or encouraging people to the extent that they're able to and have access to do things like, you know, moving their bodies and finding way, like sustainable ways of doing that and joyful ways of doing that, healing their relationship with food and having, you know, a balanced relationship with food that is peaceful and not sort of subject to the restrict binge cycle, and, you know, not demonizing certain foods and elevating others, not having foods be seen as good and bad, but having like a really flexible, peaceful relationship with food that, yes, does include some focus on nutrition, some, you know, awareness of what feels good in your body and kind of how to create balanced meals for energy and stamina and things like that, but also not making health the only thing that we're pursuing, like allowing for pleasure, allowing for satisfaction, and actually making those things important in people's relationships with food. And so, yeah, it was a long process. You know, I think it was like a good 5 years at least of sort of turning the ship in a different direction. And then I will say, like, I got really interested in and started practicing from a weight inclusive perspective. And then I had my podcast and it started to become really popular. And I started to become like have a bigger audience on social media. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not that I was an influencer per se, because I never like partnered with companies and got sponsorships and things like that the way like a professional influencer does. But, you know, I had some influence in that space. And I have still now a pretty big following on Instagram and stuff. And I think from that, you know, starting to operate a little bit more like an influencer, where I was like putting out memes and, you know, putting out ideas that were going to do well in that kind of, you know, social media space, especially on Twitter and Instagram. I used to have a Twitter account as well. I shut that down when Elon Musk took over. But, you know, it used to be like kind of a big place for me to test out ideas and post things and see what went viral and see what did well. And I think through that process, I became more strident and sort of got pushed in a less nuanced direction in terms of how I talked about these ideas, how I delivered ideas and, you know, framed things to myself and to others. And so I think about my first book, Anti-Diet, which I wrote published 5 years ago. And, you know, there are a lot of, I think I still stand behind like the evidence and the science in it and you know, I think the perspectives of people I interviewed are really valuable and all of that. But I think my tone and my way of delivering information was more black and white than I would like it to be. And then I think reflects my values now, or even really reflected my values then. You know, I think I got pushed in a direction that was like less nuanced and less compassionate and more strident than I'd like to be. So even though I always had people telling me I was really compassionate, I also had people like getting super mad at me because I was saying things in a very blunt way sometimes that, you know, in retrospect, I'm like, well, you can't please everyone. And of course, there are always going to be people who are mad at me for saying things that are maybe against what they believe. But also, I could do a better job of like building bridges and bringing people along and, you know, not being so incendiary. So I think I've had a journey with that, too, in the last couple of years. And in my latest book, The Wellness Trap, well, my second latest book, my most recent book is the workbook with Judith and Amy, which we were talking about off mic a little bit earlier. But my second book I published on my own was The Wellness Trap. And there I really strive for a lot more nuanced, you know, shades of gray kind of language about this stuff. And, you know, still very much informed by a weight-inclusive perspective and from a weight-inclusive perspective, but it's not as incendiary, perhaps, as some of the language in anti-diet.
So what do you think's different in terms of, like, how you're framing things now or coming across now? What shifted?
Yeah, I think I used to... I mean, I think this is a function of the fact that the dominant paradigm is weight stigmatizing, right? It's like, you know, the dominant paradigm says weight is the cause of all these poor health outcomes. And, you know, we have all this evidence and blah, 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 right? So I think I felt the need to sort of push back against that. I think that was part of it. And, you know, be a little bit more like certain in my framing and take out any nuanced words, because I also didn't like, I still think this is true. Like, people who are coming out of diet culture and coming out of a really weight stigmatizing way of thinking sometimes need a space that's just like totally free from any of that and sort of like a breath of fresh air to like be like, oh, right, it doesn't have to be this way and it can be totally different. And I don't have to think that anything is wrong with my body. And so there was also like an element of compassion inspiring it, where I just was like, you know what, let me say many, or let me say, like, you know, I'm thinking of an example that has been critiqued in various media outlets, unfortunately. It's just some unfortunate phrasing that I used in my book and in an op-ed I wrote years ago that's been sort of like picked up and picked apart, which is I said something like most chronic diseases that get blamed on weight can most likely be explained by other factors such as weight stigma and weight cycling. And just the fact that I said most and most likely, you know, instead of like many and may possibly, you know, or could be explained or whatever, when like, you know, the evidence is definitely there to say, yeah, like the things that get blamed on weight itself could definitely have other explanations. There is some evidence that weight cycling, for example, could account for all of the excess risk in certain, you know, couple of studies that have actually done that comparison and have found that weight cycling in and of itself, which is like repeated cycles of weight loss and regain that is more common in higher weight people, that could account for the excess risk that's associated with being in a larger body. Or, you know, there's evidence that weight stigma in and of itself is, you know, stressful to the body and could be a risk factor for all of these things that get blamed on weight itself, like diabetes and heart disease and some forms of cancer and mortality and all of that. So like, there is good evidence to suggest that this is possible. This is like a possible explanation that is not, you know, that's counter to this dominant narrative that like weight is responsible for all of these things. But I think the way that I was framing it was just like, this is it, you know, rather than, hey, like, let's look at this thing differently. And here's another possible explanation. And because this possibility is there, because this exists, and, you know, there is good evidence to say these other things are risk factors, you know, weight cycling, weight stigma, disordered eating, you know, those things are independent risk factors to people's health, regardless of body size. So, like, let's maybe stop putting the focus on body size and think about other ways we can help promote health and help people take care of themselves that don't involve them shrinking their bodies, which, by the way, doesn't work for the vast majority of people, you know? And that's the other evidence that was really compelling to me in my shift into a more weight inclusive paradigm was like, oh, wow, diets really don't work long term. Weight loss attempts of all kinds really don't have a long term effectiveness rate, you know, somewhere between, you know, depending on the study and who finances and stuff, it could be like 80% on the optimistic side or 95% on the pessimistic side of diets fail. Right. Like that's a huge percentage of diets that and, you know, intentional weight loss attempts of all kinds that don't have any long term effects. And when people go through those cycles, as they almost inevitably do, given those statistics, you know, those cycles of weight loss and regain, that in and of itself can have harmful, you know, can put their health at risk. And so, like, I just think we need to think about other ways of promoting health that don't have to do with weight and shrinking people's bodies.
So, I mean, I have my own thoughts on this, but why do you think that is not a conversation that is more, I guess, prevalent out in the media or talked about more? Why do you think that there's just so much noise and it's so the toxic diet culture like message is so loud and that people just buy into, you know, all of what you just said, that the belief is if you're in a smaller body, you're healthier and you have to lose weight to be physically healthy. And if you're in a larger body, you must be unhealthy. And because I hear it all the time, like, oh, I have to lose weight for my health. My doctor told me, right? And they just, people blindly believe that.
Yeah, I think it's so complicated. I mean, that's such a big question of like, why is this such a commonly held belief? I think there's a couple of things I'll say, you know, one is that like, it's diet culture, right? As you said, and as I define in my book, the first book, Anti-Diet, you know, I sort of tried to like get a handle on what is this thing that we call diet culture. And I came up with several tenets that I think are pretty universal to diet culture, even if it's disguising itself as wellness or taking on different forms. And it really does shapeshift and has shapeshifted over the years and decades. So it doesn't really look the same from iteration to iteration. And it can be easy to get fooled. But I think the tenets that are common to it are that it worships thinness and equates it to health and moral virtue, promotes weight loss as a means of attaining higher status, which includes health status as well as moral status, social status. Demonizes some foods and food groups while elevating others. So you get that good and bad food rhetoric and that sort of way of looking at foods as healthy and unhealthy, and then oppresses people who don't match its supposed picture of health. So when people are, you know, further away from the quote unquote ideal body or whatever that is by BMI standards or by like cultural standards that are impossibly thin for the vast majority of people, you know, people feel internal shame, and they may also experience external stigma as well, especially as you go up the scale. So, you know, all of those things I think are really deeply entrenched, and they all have their own sort of roots, including like one big part of the root system of diet culture is racism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this notion that sociologist Sabrina Strings in her 2019 book, Fearing the Black Body, really articulated well, which is that, you know, anti-Black racism was sort of necessary to justify slavery, right? That's like where it emerged. And with that sort of idea of justifying slavery came all these ways that Blackness was denigrated and sort of made to seem less than, and people were made to feel like they had to move away from it. And one of those ways was painting larger body, you know, Black bodies as larger bodies and sort of making this connection between Blackness and fatness and the, you know, resulting connection between anti-Blackness and anti-fatness ensued, which was, you know, in magazines of the I think it was the 19th century, perhaps even as early as, I know for sure that the 19th century, there were, you know, women's magazines talking about not wanting to look like not wanting to have the body of a Black or an Irish woman, and therefore needing to go on a reducing diet and slim yourself down so that you didn't look like these undesirable women. You know, it was like very overt, this connection between anti-fatness and racism at the time. So, you know, and that has become sort of sublimated and like underground in a lot of ways that diet culture still exists now, but that's part of the root system of the anti-fatness that we see in diet culture. And there are, you know, other roots to it as well. And I think one big driver of it is that it's an industry now. It's like a huge multi-billion dollar industry, multi-trillion dollar if you look worldwide. And, you know, there's businesses and practices and stuff built on these weight stigmatizing ideas, right? On the idea that like, oh yeah, we can help you shrink your larger body. And we have this medication that can do that. Or we have this diet and exercise program that can do that and come over here and do our plan and, you know, be a part of our system and pay us money. And I think whenever you have an entire industry built on something and so much money involved and so many sort of jobs and dollars at stake, I think it becomes a lot harder for it to get untangled, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as you and I were talking earlier too, I mean, speaking of who's making the money, right? I'd love to hear some of your thoughts too on, you know, the Ozempic and all these semaglutide medications mm-hmm. that are for type 2 diabetes. And I know that they're being prescribed at much higher dosages than for people who have type 2 diabetes for the side effect that occurs in some people, which is weight loss. They're touted as weight loss drugs, but they're not weight loss drugs. That's a side effect for some people. And now that's what they're being prescribed for. Because now, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, but I saw the Oprah special, I think it was on Hulu. And, you know, I was watching this kind of thinking, oh my gosh, it's looking like this wonder drug that makes people's lives better. And if you don't do it and you're in a larger body, your life's going to be, you know, so much worse. And it just was like this, it seemed to me like this very big propaganda kind of like,
yeah,
you want this drug, right? And even Weight Watchers is like in on it now. And I'm just, I don't know. My mind was blown just like, how do we get out from under this? But I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, it is so complicated. And I think you're right. There's so much propaganda out there. I mean, I will say, first of all, because I want to be compassionate and sort of own my privilege in this. Like, I don't judge or blame anyone at a higher weight for taking these drugs. I think the pressure to shrink your body is very real in diet culture. And it's understandable that people would, you know, feel like they have to make themselves smaller, larger body people, as well as anyone who even feels like they're quote unquote too fat by whatever societal standards of like their community they're in, you know, people in Hollywood, people in the public eye, like there's a huge pressure there too. And so Oprah falls into that. I think, you know, she talked about in the special, she has endured extreme levels of scrutiny and body shaming. And, you know, it's really toxic and terrible what she's had to go through in terms of people, you know, saying horrible things about her body. And as a larger body Black woman in the public eye, I think there's this added pressure of like, you know, feeling like she needs to fit this sort of white Eurocentric ideal. And so, you know, I think it's understandable that there's a market for these drugs, right? The promise of being able to escape weight stigma is very seductive. And, you know, to like, think that you could finally meet our cultural beauty standards by, and perhaps health standards as well, right? And maybe, you know, there are all these promises of better health through weight loss and better health through taking these drugs. And so that's a huge factor for some people as well, that they want to deal with health issues they might connect in their mind to weight or have had other people connect to their weight. And so all of that is at play. So like, there's a real reason I think people turn to these drugs. I think, unfortunately, the discourse has gotten so skewed into this, you know, what is like a very propagandish sort of way of speaking about them, that the downsides and the side effects and the unknowns are minimized. And there's a lot of hype, you know, there's a huge hype machine around these drugs. And I think it comes largely from at the top, it's the drug companies who make the drugs. And I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist because, you know, there are conspiracy theorists out there who will use similar sounding arguments to say like, well, the vaccine industry is corrupt and you shouldn't get vaccinated and blah, blah, blah. And that's not where I'm coming from on this. Like there, you know, there are certainly many good things the pharmaceutical industry has done, but there are also many real documented cases where they have harmed people and, you know, maybe neglected to let people know about the potential harms of their drugs in order to increase profits. You know, the OxyContin scandal is one that comes to mind. And, you know, I think that this is a very real part of the discussion that's not being had in most major media outlets. I rarely see media outlets talking about the huge levels of influence of the pharmaceutical industry, and specifically Novo Nordisk, who makes Wegovy and Ozempic. They have had massive influence on media coverage of this. They have, people on their payroll, like consultants, doctors, and other healthcare professionals who go out and talk to the media and tout the benefits of, supposed benefits of these drugs. And there is some science to show that, there is significant weight loss on these drugs in the first couple of years, and that, some people, like people do certainly for diabetes, have benefits from these drugs, right? Taking these drugs for diabetes and perhaps other blood sugar issues, it can be helpful because those drugs were, developed for diabetes purposes. But when it comes to, all the other promises they're being held out about them, and just the way they're being sort of framed as like, oh, this is safe, and, we've been testing it for 10 years because it was tested in people with diabetes. Yes, it hasn't been. These drugs have not been tested long term in people who are just taking them for weight loss and don't have diabetes. And that's a totally different, sort of physiology. That's a totally different population. And I think before massive amounts of people go on these drugs for that, they should have been tested a lot more. And what we see in the evidence that exists on these drugs is that, a small percentage, yes, so they're considered rare but serious side effects of people have things like pancreatitis, gastroparesis, bowel obstruction, acute kidney injury, and gallbladder disease. All of these things are documented in the literature on these drugs. And, it's like less than 1% for most of the conditions. Gallbladder disease, I think, is a higher risk, but, still in like the low single digits. But as more and more people take these drugs, more and more people are going to experience these rare but serious side effects. And that could potentially include, with the amount of prescriptions that are out there now, which I think is like 9 million for these drugs, we could see hundreds of thousands of people experiencing these really serious side effects. And that's, not to say, and that's not even to mention the less serious, considered less serious, but still really life-altering side effects that many people experience on these drugs. So like 80% or more of people who take them have serious gastrointestinal issues, persistent gastrointestinal issues like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, that in many cases interfere with their daily life, and in some cases so much so that people end up going off the drugs. And I think we're going to see more of that as time goes on. It was really interesting in the Oprah special that they did talk to one person who had such severe vomiting that she had to go off the drug, but they cut off. I like listened to it again and again because I was like, I think she's saying Wegovy, but they cut it off at the end. They like the audio cuts out, so you can't actually really hear the drug that she's saying she was on. And they give her like a minute to tell her story, and then they cut to this doctor who's a consultant for Novo Nordisk, a paid consultant for Novo Nordisk, to respond. And she's like, well, these are rare but serious side effects, and we really don't, or these are rare, these are not seen often in humans, and blah blah blah. And she has this whole thing about like how this is not borne out in human studies, but actually there are a ton of human studies showing these side effects in humans. What she's talking about in that clip is about the evidence on thyroid tumors specifically that were shown in rodents and are the subject of a black box warning on the drug, which is the strictest warning the FDA can issue. So it's like actually pretty significant that they put this warning on the drug. And they say that, this has been shown to cause thyroid tumors in rodents at like biologically plausible levels or something like that, clinically relevant levels. And so, that's another thing. Like, yes, animal studies do not equate to human studies, and there are differences in the physiology of rodents and humans that might make that a moot point, but we don't know. And, millions of people are now taking these drugs and sort of being guinea pigs in a way for something that is, just really not well studied enough and well understood enough. And meanwhile, these drug companies are not only seeding the media with all of these paid consultants, but they're also partnering with plus size influencers, or in some cases, formerly plus size, because now they're shrinking their bodies on these drugs. They're funding continuing education for doctors and other healthcare professionals. And so getting this, this sort of drumbeat of like, these drugs are good, push these drugs out there in the clinical space. They have also paid for like medical schools in other countries and, you know, are training doctors, and who knows how much influence they're having over the curriculum there. They've engaged in covert influence tactics in countries. You know, the U.S. is like, doesn't really have any safeguards about this. But in the U.K., where there's a national healthcare system, there's supposed to be disclosures and not undue influence of, you know, the procedure for getting new drugs adopted to the national formulary. And it seems that Novo Nordisk sort of unethically skirted those regulations, and someone who was a paid consultant or paid partner of Novo Nordisk was pushing these drugs and calling them, you know, breakthroughs and stuff like that as a way to get them on the national formulary without disclosing how much money he had taken from Novo Nordisk. And so all of that, I think, is really important to keep in mind, you know, not to like get people all conspiratorial about big pharma or whatever, because I think it's easy to like go in a direction with that that takes you down a path of wellness misinformation and, you know, all of the sort of perils of that. But I do think it's important to have some like rigorous reporting on the levels of influence we see that these drug companies are having on the public discourse about them. And from what I've seen, it is incredibly significant.
Well, and I'm also just wondering how did these become part of the American Pediatric Association or Academy's guidelines for kids? You know, they're now saying that kids need to be on these drugs as part of like weight loss, because if they're in a certain BMI category, like they need to lose weight, and kids are being prescribed these medications, like also bariatric surgery, which blows my mind. But how did that happen?
I'm not as up on the details of that. I know Reagan Chastain has done some great reporting on that at the Weight and Healthcare Substack, so I would encourage people to check that out. But I think that there is financial influence there, too. There's relationships. I don't know if it's specifically with pharmaceutical companies. I believe it is, but I think there's also relationships with what Reagan calls like AstroTurf organizations, which are like these organizations sort of pretending to be grassroots dedicated to fighting weight stigma or whatever, but are actually funded by drug companies and diet companies that are dedicated to shrinking people's bodies. So, you know, that's a huge piece of this too. And also the American Academy of Pediatrics is not actually like a scholarly body. It's a trade association for pediatricians. Like they do put out reports and scholarship and stuff too, but like at the end of the day, it's a trade association, and you know they have those sorts of pressures on them, I think, to give people what is marketable and what they want. And you know they also are funded by companies that have financial interests that they're trying to push. And so I think all of that is important to keep in mind, again, without sort of falling down like conspiracy theory rabbit holes. But like there is documented evidence of all this. And, you know, the diet industry, I think, has had a lot of hard knocks in the last 20, 30 years. You know, there's been a lot of research showing that diets don't work. A lot of people who've been sort of dissatisfied customers of diets, and there has been a growing anti-diet, weight-inclusive movement, and, you know, that has gotten some traction in the last 5 or 10 years, you know, probably 5 years or so. So there, you know, to your point earlier about, like, why isn't there more discussion about this in the media? I think there is starting to be, which is cool. You know, it's exciting to see some debate and discussion and like, you know, people with different perspectives and evidence-based perspectives about, you know, about diet culture and weight science, like speaking up and being spotlighted in the media. And I think that has the diet industry in some ways running scared. You know, I think there has been documented evidence of like major diet companies losing market share. You know, Weight Watchers still is losing a lot of market share. And so grabbing on to the next big thing and to these like blockbuster diet drugs as a way of keeping themselves afloat, and the cultural discourse around them where it's like they're being, you know, there's this language that's sort of co-opting the language of anti-diet and, you know, weight inclusive activism, where it's like talking about weight stigma and talking about weight cycling, but twisting that in service of saying like these drugs are your solution to weight stigma and weight cycling. It's really problematic. But it's also, you know, seems to me evidence that they are trying to like shape shift and stay relevant as best they can.
So, you know, if people are listening and wondering, okay, so your new book and workbook is out. Is there information in there that can help them focus on like less the quick fix kind of expensive things that like, they're being bombarded with on social media that can help them focus more on health, wellness, like being more balanced? Like, can you talk about what's in the book and your workbook?
Yeah. So, you know, the workbook we wrote to help people just try to tune out that noise, all of that noise from diet culture. And it, you know, it doesn't get into specifics about particular diets really, but just to, it's just designed to help people kind of fight back against those enduring principles of diet culture, the weight stigma, the food shaming, the anti-fat bias, all of that, like, you know, to help people get more grounded in their own relationships with food and their bodies, to trust themselves again, to push back the tide of weight stigma to the extent that they possibly can in this world, you know, just to have more tools to deal with it and to try to be resilient to it as much as possible. So, you know, we have chapters on kind of looking at the diet mentality, the diet mindset, and why it exists, where it comes from, and how you can start to challenge it. We talk about weight stigma. We talk about, you know, the evidence that weight stigma is a risk factor in and of itself, and how helping people with a weight-inclusive approach has actually been shown to lead to greater well-being on lots of measures and is also more sustainable than diets. We talk about why food is not good or bad and why it's important to make peace with all foods. And again, I know this can sound radical to people who are new to this idea, and I'm not saying, like, you know, only eat processed foods for the rest of your life or whatever. But I'm also not saying you'll never eat processed foods again if you become an intuitive eater or whatever, because that is sort of a way that intuitive eating gets twisted into a diet. And it's like, you know, as with all things, I think we want to have balance and autonomy and self-reliance and sort of be able to make decisions for ourselves that feel good in the face of pressure from outside, you know, decisions that feel good to us and that are aligned with our values and who we are. And so, you know, saying that there's no such thing as good and bad foods means that we're not demonizing any foods, we're not having anything off limits. And, you know, you are allowed to eat whatever it is that you think you shouldn't eat. Of course, if you have any medical issues, you know, legitimate food allergies or medical considerations like diabetes or something that, you know, you need to avoid particular foods, of course, for self-care, that's important. But, you know, barring any of that, really thinking that there's nothing off limits, I think can help people feel a lot more in charge, actually, in their relationship with food, rather than being kind of pulled around between following the rules and breaking the rules, following the rules and rebelling, you know, in this constant cycle that people get into. So we get into all that in the book. We talk about, like, there's a couple chapters on trauma and sort of trauma-informed approaches to binge eating and body image. And then we also talk about food and nutrition. And that's like almost the last chapter, because really talking about nutrition and kind of getting into the specifics of it is so tricky for anyone who's in the diet mindset or like just starting to untangle it. I think it's so easy to see nutrition information through this lens of diet culture and get really black and white and fixated on it and sort of, you know, not treat it with this gentle approach and this light touch that we really encourage people to do. So, you know, we kind of work on helping people unpack all of the stuff that they've learned through diet culture and, you know, challenge their own internalized weight stigma, challenge these sort of received ideas about, good and bad, black and white ways of thinking about food. And then eventually get to a place where they're thinking about nutrition a little bit in ways that are just really like helpful for energizing and, you know, making them feel satisfied and fueled throughout the day and kind of helping people feel good and feel their best, but not, you know, getting into the minutia and the nitty gritty of macros or calories or anything like that.
Awesome. So have you gotten feedback from the book in terms of how people have been taking it, especially if they've been kind of entrenched in toxic diet culture and really struggling with all of this?
Yeah, we've gotten some great feedback, especially from clinicians, I think, who are using it with their clients who, you know, have been looking for ways to untangle some of these issues for themselves as well, because a lot of clinicians also struggle with their own disordered eating, you know, which is something that I didn't realize until I started doing this work and, you know, hearing everybody's story of how they came to do this work. I'm like, oh, right. You know, clinicians are people too. Doctors and therapists and dietitians are people too. And they have their own reasons for being attracted to this kind of work and, you know, giving nutrition information and all that. So it's been cool to see clinicians talking about like how it's helping them with their clients, but also how it's helping them heal themselves and sort of untangle some of the last threads of diet culture that they didn't realize were still tangled up in them. And, you know, we've gotten some great feedback from clients as well, or people who are just kind of everyday readers, not healthcare professionals, who said that it's been really helpful for them on their path to healing their relationships with food. My first book, Anti-Diet, I think, you know, partly because of that strident tone, perhaps, but also partly because of like the timing of it and the sort of the level of like arguments and myth busting or whatever that's in it. Mm-hmm. I got a lot of feedback of that, of like, this is mind blowing, you know, but I didn't really include in that like a how to of like, how do you move now that you know all this, like, how do you move from diet culture into a more peaceful relationship with food? How do you shift more into intuitive eating and a weight inclusive approach? And so this workbook is really our attempt to offer that, you know, and to like, there is definitely some stuff that will probably blow people's minds in there too. You know, we do have evidence and kind of arguments breaking down some of the common beliefs in diet culture, but we also really focus on like helping people heal themselves. And we have a lot of exercises and activities in there that are just designed to help people like shift their relationships with food and their bodies and think through it for themselves. And so that I think is like almost a deeper practice. You know, it's not just like the holy F, you know, like this is crazy or whatever, but it's actually like, okay, here's like how I'm going to shift my relationship with food into a more loving and compassionate and, you know, ultimately self-caring place. And I think that is truly what I hope to be giving with this book, you know.
It's fantastic. So I'm almost 100% positive people listening are going, "Yes, how do I find this?" Like, it sounds like something that'd be great for me to read and pick up and no, it would be very helpful. And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, yes, this would be helpful for many of the people I work with as well. So how can they find the book and get their hands on it?
Yeah, thank you so much. So people can go to my website, christyharrison.com/workbook, to get a direct link to buy it. There's like Amazon links and Bookshop, and then in other countries as well. You can also just search for it in Amazon and Bookshop, but it has like the longest title ever because we just wanted to capture keywords for all of these things. And it's really important, but it's called The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook. And then it also has a very long subtitle. So it might be a little easier just to go to christyharrison.com/workbook rather than typing all that out.
And then if people want to follow you, maybe they already are, but if they're not, how can they find you?
Yeah, so I am most active on Substack. You can find me on my Rethinking Wellness newsletter and podcast at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. I also am still doing my first podcast, Food Psych, just once a month now. Rethinking Wellness is now weekly, but Food Psych is, I brought it back after a little bit of a hiatus to give a place to talk with people about their relationships with food and, you know, healing their body image and all of that. So you can find that at christyharrison.com/foodpsych or wherever you're listening to this. You can also just search for Food Psych, which is FOOD space PSYCH, or Rethinking Wellness, wherever you're listening to this.
Fantastic. Christy, you've been such a pleasure. You've given so much amazing information. I really appreciate all your time, all this information.
Thank you.
Any last final words before we end?
Just thank you so much for having this conversation, for holding space and the work you're doing. I think it's so important to be having these conversations and, you know, bringing a different way of approaching food and weight to lots and lots of people. So thank you.
Well, thank you as well. You're obviously influencing lots of people and doing fantastic work. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, the publisher, or the guest are rendering legal, accounting, clinical, or any other professional information. If you want a professional, you should find one.